In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow. There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the house of cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
On this episode, a Canadian JFK assassination researcher describes how he smuggled the Zapruder film into Canada in the early 1970s.
I was just sitting there in the plane thinking, oh, please, let's go, let's take off and let me get out of here.
If you enjoy Conspiracy Unlimited, why not become a Conspiracy Unlimited Plus member? For just $1.99 per month, you'll gain access to two bonus, exclusive, commercial-free episodes per month, plus access to my back catalog of episodes. That's over 350 episodes. To subscribe, just go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Gain Access to Premium Episodes. Again, go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Get Access to Premium Episodes, or click on the link in the episode notes. Conspiracy Unlimited Plus, for less than $2 per month. Why not sign up today?
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs, here's Richard Serrett.
Welcome to your Wednesday. The Zapruder film is the most famous, most analyzed film footage in history. Abraham Zapruder unexpectedly captured the assassination of President Kennedy in a home movie while filming the presidential limousine and motorcade as it traveled through Dealey Plaza. The film is regarded as the most complete footage of the assassination. The footage was captured on an 8mm Bell & Howard Zoomatic Director Series model,
top of the line when it was purchased in 1962. Zapruder had planned to film the motorcade from his office window, but decided to choose a more optimal spot in Dealey Plaza where the motorcade would be passing. He chose to film on top of a 4-foot concrete abutment which extends from a retaining wall that was part of the John Neely Bryan concrete pergola on the grassy knoll north of Elm Street in Dealey Plaza. Zapruder's secretary, Marilyn Stitzman, offered to assist Zapruder as he suffered from vertigo and was apprehensive about standing on the abutment alone. While Stitzman stood behind Zapruder and held his coat to steady him, he began filming the presidential motorcade as it turned down Houston Street onto Elm Street in the front of the book depository. Zapruder's film captured 26.6 seconds of the traveling motorcade carrying President Kennedy on 486 frames of Kodak Kodachrome II safety film. Zapruder's film captured the fatal headshot that struck Kennedy as his limousine passed almost directly in front of Zapruder and Stitzman's position, 65 feet from the center of Elm Street. Zapruder would later recall that he immediately knew that President Kennedy's wound was fatal as he saw the president's head explode like a firecracker. Walking back to his office amid the confusion following the shots, Zapruder encountered the Dallas Morning News reporter Harry McCormick, who was standing near Zapruder and noticed he was filming the motorcade. McCormick was acquainted with Agent Forrest Sorrells of the Secret Service's Dallas office and offered to bring Sorrells to Zapruder's office. Zapruder agreed and returned to his office. McCormick later found Sorrells outside the sheriff's office at Main and Houston, and together they walked to Zapruder's office. Zapruder agreed to give the film to Sorrells on the condition it would be used only for investigation of the assassination. The three then took the film to the television station WFAA to be developed. After it was realized that WFAA was unable to develop Zapruder's footage, the film was taken to Eastman Kodak's Dallas processing plant later that afternoon, where it was immediately developed. As the Kodachrome process requires different equipment for duplication than for simple development, Zapruder's film was not developed until around 6:30 p.m. The original developed film was then taken to Jameson Film Company, where three additional copies were exposed. These were returned to Kodak around 8 p.m. for processing. Zapruder kept the original plus one copy and gave the other two copies to Sorrells, who sent them to Secret Service headquarters in Washington. While at WFAA, Zapruder described on live television the assassination of President Kennedy. Later that evening, he was contacted at home by Richard Stolle, an editor at Life magazine. They arranged to meet the following morning to view the film. Following day, November the 24th, Life purchased all rights to the film for a total of $150,000. That's approximately $1.25 million today. The night after the assassination, Zapruder said he had had a nightmare in which he saw a booth in Times Square advertising, "See the President's Head Explode." He determined that while he was willing to make money from the film, he didn't want the public to see the full horror of what he'd seen. Therefore, a condition of the sale to Life was that frame 313 showing the fatal shot would be withheld. Although he made a profit from selling the film, he asked that the amount he was paid not be publicly disclosed. He later donated $25,000 of the money he was paid to the widow of Officer J.D. Tippit, the Dallas police officer who was shot and killed, supposedly by Lee Harvey Oswald, some 45 minutes after the assassination of Kennedy. In 1975, Time, which owned Life magazine, sold the film back to the Zapruders for a dollar. In 1978, the Zapruders allowed the film to be stored at the National Archives and Records Administration, where it remains. In 1999, the Zapruders donated the copyright of the film to the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. Here to discuss the Zapruder film and his role in smuggling the film into Canada in the early 1970s is JFK assassination researcher, media scientist, and archivist for the late Marshall McLuhan, Nelson Thal. Hey, Nelson, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, terrific, Richard. It's just great being back with you on air.
We're just a few days away from the anniversary of the JFK assassination. Let's see, do some quick math. This would be 57 years since the assassination of the 35th president. And you have a very important connection to the JFK assassination and specifically the Zapruder film. You smuggled a copy of the Zapruder film into Canada. How did that happen?
basically, the way in which I was able to get it is through Penn Jones. I had met Penn Jones. I had reached out to Penn around 1969-70, right after the Clay Shaw trial. I heard of Penn Jones from May Brussels tapes. I used to get, I was a Brussels sprout and got all the tapes from May Brussels, found out about a Penn Jones, and wrote to him. He was the publisher of the Midlothian paper, and I had some connections to my own in the newspaper business, and I used a publisher to give me a letter of reference so that he would know that I wasn't just a kook, because, of course, you know, Penn was always bombarded by different people. He had to be careful. And so I went down and spent a couple of weeks with him in Dallas. And he had told me that Garrison was looking for ways to get this out. He had a copy. Penn had a copy. And he was looking for ways. And remember, the media, there was no internet. The media, of course, was highly controlled. It was illegal to have in your possession this film. And I suggested that I would use best efforts to get it aired out of border stations in Canada if he could get me a copy. And he thought that Garrison would be interested in using that as a route if I could prove it to him. And basically, to make a long story short, I met with him, and he realized that I was a dedicated researcher and didn't have any connections to the intelligence industries or anything. So I was bona fide. And so through Penn, he arranged for me to get a copy. The thing took about 2 years.
Okay, so let's just back up. Penn Jones, of course, as you mentioned, journalist, was one of the early critics of the Warren Commission's report on the assassination of JFK. This is something he wrote about in the Midlothian Mirror, this newspaper I guess he bought back in the 1940s for something like $4,000. So you reached out to Penn Jones. Talk to me about why Garrison was making copies of the Zapruder film. In other words, he was using it as evidence, but he couldn't walk away with the Zapruder film. Who owned it at that time?
Okay, well, the film was bought by Time Life from Zapruder, and it was sealed away. The Warren Commission sealed it away out of the public's view in 1964. Then in 1969, when Jim Garrison subpoenaed the film from Time Life because he charged Clay Shaw and eventually Lewis Mortimer Bloomfield, but publicly it only came out that he charged Clay Shaw, and with the murder of the President Kennedy. And during the lunch break, he had the Kodak Labs in New Orleans, this would be, because he was the district attorney for New Orleans and the trial was there. He took the copy to the Kodak Labs and got copies made and then brought it back, did that all during the lunch hour break, the court break, and that's how he got the copy. Originally, eventually, the copy that subpoenaed went back to Time Life. So he was left with a couple of copies.
Was Garrison breaking the law by making copies?
Definitely. Definitely. He broke the law the minute he took the tape out of the court to the Kodak Labs. Yeah, he broke the law.
So his intention was from the beginning, get a copy of the film, make copies, and try and distribute it to researchers around North America.
Yeah, I mean, by the time he got to court, he realized that, remember, he had approximately five different witnesses that he had subpoenaed, and all five never made it to court. With three of them, the first time in the history of the United States, a subpoena from a district attorney from one state was turned down by the governor of another state, namely California. Reagan struck down his subpoena. One of them was Arcatcha Smith, and another, I think it was Gordon Novel. I don't remember the third one, but it may not have been Novel, but it was Arcatcha Smith and some other guys. And three of the guys were living in California, and Reagan struck it down. So, and then Jim Hink wound up in a mental asylum, and he couldn't get any of his real main witnesses. Of course, David Ferry was murdered, suicided. So he realized that things were going against him. And by the time, if he had an opportunity to make a copy, the Zapruder film was so important because it was a smoking gun, which completely destroyed the government's case. And that's what the beauty of the Zapruder film is. It's a blatant smoking gun. Shows right. A man shot from the front, and yet the government's case is all about Oswald, and he was never in front of Kennedy.
The film, then, how was Garrison, he did play the film before to the jurors, correct?
Yes. Oh, yeah, he showed it in the courtroom.
And then he had to return it to Time Warner, but in the meantime, he made copies. Penn Jones,
right.
Penn Jones trusted you. So your mission was, again, to bring it to Canada and get
right.
it aired on a border station, and that was significant. Why? Why a border station?
My plan was I had a lot of connections through Mae Brussels and the whole JFK Lancer, that whole convention network. I had students who could turn on, get into the library and turn on their tape machines at the universities. It was all done through the universities. My contact were, I was at University of Toronto, and we used to give lectures, and guys from the States would come up. And through word of mouth and talking, we made contacts with people in Rochester and Syracuse and Detroit and Buffalo, and everywhere somebody could receive the broadcast from CBLT with its tower on Jarvis Street. You could get that in Syracuse and Rochester and Buffalo. You could pick up that channel and turn on remember, nobody had these big 2.5 inch or 2 inch tape reel to reel. They were in libraries. So everybody made plans. They worked at it. It took us many months so that everybody got a way to get access to the library machines at night. And once that was set up, then I coordinated that with five guys mostly. And those five guys, they passed, had other people, and I didn't have time to figure out and ask them who are their people. I just trusted them that they would put together a chain of universities along the border that could get the signal and get people to make copies.
So you take the Zapruder film in, can you tell us the border station, which one it was?
Yeah, one was CBLT and the other one was the Windsor station, CBC Windsor. I can't remember. The main one was CBLT.
In Toronto?
Toronto 6, yeah.
Okay, so a copy is taken to Windsor and CBC in Toronto. And
right.
You had made connections and their videotape.
I had a connection with the senior executive in the CBC in Toronto. So after him, we go up the ladder. He reported to a guy in Ottawa. So he was the highest ranking executive in Toronto for the CBC.
So you said, I've got a copy of the Zapruder film. He can't just air it during the normal broadcast day. Otherwise, he would be in possession.
It was done at 2 a.m. The color bars went down and they broadcasted it 3 or 4 times. He broadcasted, just started it playing at 2 a.m. and let it run for approximately 2 minutes and then shut it down and put the color bars back down. And, you know, I was at the University of Toronto making a copy. I was at the U of T.
Right.
At the St. Mike's Laboratory at a machine tuned into CBLT and made a copy onto the tape there.
The idea here is this is after the broadcast day is finished. The test pattern goes up, but they brought it down
right.
just for a couple of minutes.
Right.
They play the Zapruder film, mainly for the benefit of those who have been alerted ahead of time at university libraries to push record on their giant videotape machines This is how it got disseminated. And had you been caught smuggling that film out of the United States, what would have happened to you?
70 years in jail.
70?
It would be 70 years is what Garrison told me. He said, you know, if you're caught, you could get 70 years in jail. The judge could throw the book at you.
And what about for the executive at the CBC who gave the green light to air it?
Remember, first of all, you got to remember the chronology here. First of all, 1971, I meet Penn Jones. By the time I get a copy of it and ready to go, it was at least a year. It may have been a little bit more than a year, but it was approximately a year to a year and a half. It was only once. Now, the danger happened when I flew down to, and I flew down to Dallas to get it from Ben Jones. I didn't get it from Garrison. He had to have a buffer between he and I because it was illegal for him to. He got it to Penn. I don't know how he got it to Penn. That was their business. The less I knew, the better. And then Penn met me at the airport in Dallas. I took the film and got back on the plane. I didn't even stay at the gate. Like, in those years, you could go to the gate. Penn could drive, like, come right to, where the gate is. I got off the plane. I had a ticket to go back, and they were using the same plane. I had found out in advance because I wanted to stay on the plane. I only got out to get the film from Penn, and then I went back into the plane.
Right.
And I just was, that was the dangerous part. And then fortunately, I was just sitting there in the plane thinking, oh, please, let's go. Let's take off and let me get out of here. And it went smoothly. I was overly cautious and probably overly paranoid, too, and got to Canada and back to Toronto and just came through customs. I didn't have anything to declare. I mean, it was only this Zapruder film was on a little an 8mm tape.
Right.
Like it goes in the palm of your hand.
486 frames. It's 26 seconds.
And there's no metal detector in those years.
I was going to ask you, how did you prevent the film from getting, not fogged. It's already been developed, so it's not going to fog because of the X-ray machine.
No. And there is no X-ray machine. It's 1972.
Right.
Those were different years, I mean, you didn't have a cell phone. You didn't you didn't have a camera. Well, I had a Pentax camera, but the last thing I wanted to do was take pictures. But anyway, I got back into Canada. And then once I was in Canada, then I approached the CBC, not until then.
Right. And how long did it take you to negotiate? I mean, what was the first response? I can't play this. This is too hot to handle. This is radioactive.
Yeah, the first response was, I really hope I can do this. I got to figure out a way to do it. And he went away for a couple of weeks and came back. And he realized he figured out this is how he was going to do it. And he said that he'd find out when the shift changed and the cleaning staff came in, because his plan was that if someone was to come to him, he'd say his answer was the cleaning lady was dusting the board, flipped the switch by mistake. It was just an accident. It was only done for a couple of seconds. She corrected it right away. And that would have been his alibi.
Plausible deniability.
Yeah. And of course, nothing ever did happen. I don't know if anybody was on at that time. I don't know about the loggers. I once asked him, what about the loggers? Will it be on the logger? He said, don't worry, I've looked after that. I mean, so he looked after it, and I never had, he never had a problem, or I didn't have a problem ever. Saw him now and then over the years. He was a good friend of my aunt's. I once spent sometime in the 80s, I once spent a New Year's Eve with him. Anyway, they were anxious. These guys were interested in getting it aired as well.
And so how many universities actually made copies?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, I remember the five guys who I spoke to, and one of the five said he had another guy in another university town that could get the signal. I guess it was six, but it could have been more because, everybody were they were reaching out to all their friends saying, look, everybody, get to your university campus, get to the university library, 2 a.m, get there, channel CBC, channel 6, get the machines ready. And I don't know in the end how many, because the last thing I wanted to do was make contact with them afterwards.
Right.
I only spoke to the one main guy because I didn't want there to be any phone records or anything,
mean? You didn't want it coming back to you. And so did they in turn also then make copies and distribute it in other ways?
Listen, I'm sure they could have. I only kept in touch with that one guy, and we would see each other regularly at the JFK Lancer conventions in Dallas. So once in 1 year I'd see him, and I wouldn't see him for maybe 4 or 5 years, and I'd see him, and every time we'd see each other, we'd sort of catch up, and we sort of think back about the days and how heady they were, because years later, the Zapruder film was made public.
Right. Geraldo Rivera aired it on a television show, a major U.S. network. When was that, 1975?
Something like that. He aired it in about 75. Maybe he aired it because it was the thing that I did by getting it out. I certainly got it out before him.
Yes, you did.
It was 1973 by the time we did it.
73. I'm wondering if anyone actually saw it who was not intended to see it. Maybe they were up late, they were watching their TV, you know, maybe they fell asleep in front of the TV, they wake up, the test pattern comes down, and all of a sudden they see the Zapruder film. Did you ever hear from anyone who saw it by accident?
I never heard of it, no. I never heard anything about it. The CBC never got any complaints, to the best of my knowledge.
More of my conversation with JFK assassination researcher Nelson Thal when Conspiracy Unlimited returns. I can't stop talking about the pomegranate super tea from my friends at Get the Tea. They actually changed the name. It used to be known as Formula 13 Pomegranate Cleansing Tea, but this gentle cleansing tea now contains a new, stronger formula. All I know is it still tastes great, it's still refreshing, and it still provides me with energy and a sense of well-being. This new blend of tea contains some of the same ingredients as those that are in the Life Change teas, but with added natural pomegranate flavor and stevia to give it a natural, slightly sweetened taste. One pouch of tea contains 8 tea bags, enough to last for 1 month. I brew 2 gallons at a time, and then it steeps in cold water. Into the fridge it goes, and that's enough to last for the week. I start my day every day with a 16-ounce, cool, refreshing glass of this amazing herbal, non-GMO, caffeine-free tea. It provides a daily gentle cleanse that rids my body of any intruders. A healthy gut is the key to a healthy body. So, come on board and find out for yourself. The Super Tea also comes in peppermint. These teas are not available in any store. Use the code UNLIMITED and all your orders ship for free. Get your tea from GetTheTea.com.
If there's one thing money can't buy, it's sanity. Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
Nelson Thal is here, and we're talking about the Zapruder film and the JFK assassination.
The Zapruder film that was handed off to you by Penn Jones at Love Field in Dallas in 1970 or 71, the film that was passed off to you and that Garrison had and made copies of, do we know whether that was altered in any way before Garrison got it?
Well, yes, Garrison, the final, first of all, the copy that was given to the Warren Commission was a very, very scratchy copy, and they claim that it had frames missing, especially the frames around the Stemmons Freeway sign. Was years later, a guy named Robert Groden came out with a really terrific copy years later. The Kodak specialist, film specialist, and he came out with a copy. But it was certainly the copy that was given to the Warren Commission. They made it look as bad as they could, scratchy as possible.
But the copy that Garrison had, was that pretty much?
It was. It was. It wasn't the best copy. It wasn't like Groden's copy, but still, it was enough that you could see it well. There was no doubt you could see Kennedy being shot from the front.
But was it altered? Because there's some speculation that frames were flipped or cut out. I mean, did Garrison's copy have any alterations?
Let me just say this. If you were the CIA and you wanted to alter this film, you would alter it so that it would agree with the government's story, not detract.
Exactly, right.
So whatever they did, they didn't do anything to help their cause. If anything, they put out a copy of a man shot from the front. Now, remember, in the actual summary and conclusion volume, they did in that all, in the where they showed it frame by frame, they switched frame 312 with 313. So you can see Mary Moorman walking towards the car and then back up a step because they flipped the... They flipped those and they got caught at it. Now, that is they did because that way, if you were looking at it very carefully with an eyeglass, you'd say, oh, his head went forward. But they flipped 312 and 313. But more than that, it's frame 231 that is the damaging frame, because in that frame, you have a picture of Connally with his hand on his right hand holding his Stetson hat, and yet Kennedy's clutching his throat. Now, that means the bullet has already passed through Kennedy's neck. The Warren Commission said That's the same bullet that smashed Connolly's right wrist, but in frame 231, his wrist is visible holding his Stetson hat. It's not where it was down by his thigh when he turned around.
Right, that's the magic bullet that miraculously ended up on Connolly's stretcher at Parkland in pristine condition.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, put there by Jack Ruby's nephew. I can't remember his name right now, who was the intern. I mean, the whole thing is a joke.
So let me ask you about Abraham Zapruder, this Ukrainian-born American clothing manufacturer,
right,
who would later say that he didn't want to go, he didn't intend on taking his camera. You know what a number of people have pointed out to me that I never even thought of? Here is a guy who's holding a camera pointed at the presidential limousine. All of a sudden, shots are ringing out. There's bedlam everywhere. He doesn't duck. The camera's not shaky. It's rock solid. How do you account for that?
Well, Penn Jones always said that Zapruder was sent there purposely.
And in your research, have you ever been able to link Zapruder to any of the characters involved in the assassination?
You know, the way these assassinations are done is a guy who's sent to Dewey Plaza to shoot the film, he's not necessarily told that Kennedy's going to get shot. He's told, hey, we're going to have a big event. You know what? Like a number of the shooters were told that you're just to shoot over his head. We're just wanting to warn the president. So who knows what Zapruder was said. But, you know, when they plan these military operations, there may be five shooters, but none of the five shooters have met. They've all been training in different locations in the country. They're all coming together at the same spot, same time, but none of them know that the other guy, what he's to do, they're a shooter, there's a man with them with a walkie-talkie, and they're told when to shoot, period. So everything's cellularized, so no one person knows that can see the big operation.
As you point out, the Zapruder film actually is the smoking gun. It proves that Kennedy was shot from in front and the side.
Right.
Why then... You know, we have this big JFK death list. We have these cleaning teams that come in and clean up all the evidence. They sanitize the vehicle. Why would they allow the Zapruder film to exist if it doesn't help their case?
First of all, I don't think there's such a thing as the perfect crime. Well, in the midst of evil and wickedness, people make mistakes. There's incompetence. And they sealed away the film, and they expected it to be sealed away. I'm sure they fought against it being released to Garrison at the time and lost out. But remember, they made sure that Garrison's witnesses were all either eliminated or the subpoena struck down. So there was a big effort to stop the truth from getting out, as we know, and this was one of the efforts, and a lot of pressure was brought against Garrison. Of course, the movie JFK by Oliver Stone is a tremendous documentary about what really went on behind the scenes.
I just want to ask you about one figure that we see in the Zapruder film. He's called the Umbrella Man. He's been identified as Louis Stephen Witt. We see this figure in the Zapruder film with an umbrella. At one point, it's open, and then it's closed. Who is or was Louis Stephen Witt, and what was his role?
Well, Penn Jones always felt that whoever would come out as the Umbrella Man would be a double. It would be somebody who looks like him, but the real guys are never left alive because they can't afford to have them left alive. I mean, that was why David Ferry made his nighttime trip to Houston. He was in a plane and he supposedly flew the shooters out, and they probably threw them out into the Gulf of Mexico. They got rid of all these people right away. So whoever came out as the Umbrella Man, nobody really honestly believed that it really was the Umbrella Man. They'd never leave somebody in that position alive.
If he was involved, what was his role supposed to be?
His role was simple. You got shooters on the ground. You've got a second assassination team out on the other side of the Stemmons Freeway. That means a whole new story. If the lone assassin doesn't work, if they miss there, they can't leave Kennedy alive. So they had a commando team of Cubans that would have assaulted him and blown up. And they had to have him on the street very close to where the gunshots were first fired to make the decision as to whether the second assassination team has to go to work that day. And it, of course, that's why the shooting started right at the point where the Umbrella Man was standing, so he could make that assessment. And the second assassination team, which there was a lot of documentation about, but they never talk about it. I don't even think Stone put it in the movie, but there was a group of school teachers on a bridge right after the Stemmons Freeway. Teacher came and the teacher filled out an affidavit saying she saw men with automatic rifles under the bridge where she was standing. And she was, so it was a second assassination team is what it was that Garrison figured.
So the Umbrella Man was there to signal the second team if they were needed.
Right. Someone had to decide, is this guy, were we successful? Is he dead? Is he, or is he alive? Because if they miss him, then we've got to go with a whole new story. We can't do the, if they had missed, then we would have been, we never would have heard of Lee Harvey Oswald. And it would have been blamed on a group of Cuban revolutionaries who were angry at Kennedy for the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Fascinating.
Trying to kill Castro. It's a Castro team. Remember, the whole purpose of the assassination was really to get an excuse, not just, first of all, the assassination of Kennedy was an attack on the executive branch of government. They wanted to remove and destroy the United States by taking out the executive branch. And Kennedy just happened to be the holder of that office at the time that we realized that this was everything in place. This is the time to act if you're going to take it out. And that's why the book by Mark Lane is called Executive Action, because this was the purpose was to take out the executive branch. And might I say they were successful. The Nazi connection to the JFK assassination, the Nazis were tremendously involved, Walter Dornberger and the other Nazis. And they did take over the White House. And the battle we have now with Trump is Trump's one of the patriots fighting against trying to get these Nazi collaborators out of the country.
We can do an entire show, and I think we have. We'll revisit that topic, the Nazi connection to the JFK assassination and the rise of the Fourth Reich, to borrow a title from Jim Mars, the late Jim Mars. But
you did a TV show on it. People should go and see that show at Film One on YouTube.
That's right. That's right. The Conspiracy Show television program. It is available on YouTube. And it is the rise of the Fourth Reich. You were in that episode as well, Nels. In finishing up, though, on the Zapruder film, you mentioned that when it aired on CBC, you rushed over to the University of Toronto, the St. Mike's, into the library so that you could make a copy. Do you still have that copy?
Well, the copy's on reel-to-reel tape, I do. But I don't have a reel-to-reel machine anymore. I don't have a reel-to-reel anymore. But I've got it. We've all got it off the internet. We've made copies. I mean, years ago, I made copies once it was on the internet. I do have a tape. Do you remember I put it on 2.5-inch reel-to-reel tape for those big woolen sack machines?
Yes.
I don't know if you remember back
yes.
in the 70s. So I had it on that. I never did transfer it off of that, but I still do have it on that. But it's sort of obsolete now that it's available and the Grodin film came out.
I suppose, but it's still a fascinating chapter in history, Nelson, in which you played a very active role. As you said, you could have been put away for 70 years had you been caught. And thanks to you, that Zapruder film was distributed and disseminated to many researchers around the world before Geraldo Rivera aired it on network television. Great story, Nelson. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks again, and thanks very much for everything, Richard. Keep up the great work. Bye-bye.
Okay, before I dim the lights in my little studio beneath the stairs, I'll be back in a flash to tell you a little bit about an upcoming episode. Hey there, I'm hard at work on another edition of Inner Sanctum, my free monthly newsletter. Inner Sanctum features my monthly brief, a column of my thoughts and opinions on what's happening in the world. It features a spotlight on a past guest, a look ahead to an upcoming episode of my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show. It features a look at this month in conspiracy and UFO history, and my Conspiracy Unlimited podcast, Episode Pick of the Month, and so much more. To get your free monthly newsletter, Inner Sanctum, delivered to your email inbox, just go to my website, strangeplanet.ca, strangeplanet.ca. Scroll down to the bottom of the page and click on Inner Sanctum and register. It's fast, easy, and again, absolutely free. Coming up next time, Michael Bodine describes his life growing up psychic.
I'm a big denial guy. I love denial. And I tried to ignore all the things that were happening for years. But after a while, you can't keep ignoring it. When I was a little kid, when I was like 5, there was an ambulance that went by our house. And I knew my mother and my sister were in that ambulance. I just knew it. I could see colors around people there my whole life. And I just thought everybody could see colors. But I kept trying my best to deny it. But finally, I just got to the point where, and I remember trying to tell it to my family or trying to explain it to them, like, does this happen to you where you meet somebody and you just know that this is about to happen or that's about to happen? And they didn't have that same thing. And so I just slowly just said, okay, screw it. What about this stuff? Why do I have this and what am I going to do with it?
Until then, I'm Richard Serrett. So long for now.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need constant petting.